Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Susan Knoll. Thank you so much for joining me on my very first episode with Stand for Truth Radio Show on the Contending for Truth Radio Network. I'm so glad to be here, and I'm so thrilled to be able to come to you and talk to you. This show, I want to tell you a little bit about what this show is going to be about and who I am. A little background on myself. I am a former practicing attorney. I'm a licensed psychotherapist. I'm also a blogger, a writer, and an author. I blog for several conservative websites, some that you may know. Joe for America. Everybody knows Joe the Plumber. Also for theblaze.com. I'm a contributor there. And one last one is humanevents.com, and that is a conservative website as well. And I have my own website at susanknowles.com. That's SusanKnowles.com. So I hope that you will check all of that out. This show is going to be about talking about the news and looking at it from a truth standpoint. Basically, when we talk about things, we're going to get into the issues, talk about what really matters. And it can be on a variety of subjects that are in the news. And again, we're going to approach it from, standing for truth. And I think it's very important for us as Americans, as patriots, to be out there sort of, talking about things, being truthful about things, and looking, for solutions. We want to be able to sort of band together, stay together, and find solutions. We can't always just sort of complain about what's going on. We really need to, you know, look at something in depth, find out why it's happening, find out sort of the root cause of some of these things, and then find out what we can do about them. I think when we do that, we'll be able to get a lot accomplished. You know, the America that we once knew is no longer. You know, if we stand around and wait for it to come back, I don't think it's going to happen. I do think that it can come back differently and stronger than it was before, and I think that is something that we need to be working toward. You know, it's very difficult to try to in this day and time when you turn on the radio and you turn on the TV, you know, all you can hear is you know, Ebola is something else that Obama has done. You know, different things that are happening that we just absolutely seem to no longer have any control over. And we need to be able to look at things differently and figure out what it is that we need to do differently. And you know, the people on the other side, the progressives, they've looked at this for a very long period of time, and they've figured out what it is that they need to do in order to get into the hearts and the minds and the souls of those that they want to change. You know, if you look at Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky, you know, that, if you haven't read that, you really need to read that. That is the playbook. And we as conservatives, we really don't have a playbook. And we have, you know, talked about sort of what the other side does, you know, who the other side is and how bad things are. But we don't have a strategy. We've been really nice. I think that's been our strategy. Let's be really nice and treat people well, and as we should. But we also need to look at things from a perspective of, you know, what's happening to us. If you look at it with political correctness, it's been a way to silence us. And unfortunately, we have bought into it. We have allowed political correctness to make us sit down and shut up. And that is exactly what, you know, the progressives would have us do. And we can't afford to do that. We need to be getting out there and talking about the issues, getting out there and getting people on our side. And it's not about, you know, forcing people into doing something they don't want to do. I think when we talk about who we are and about the issues from a logical, rational point of view, I think that we'll get people who are also excited about our way of thinking. But, you know, if you look at the progressives today, and especially on the topic of, let's say, socialism is kind of where our country seems to be headed. The 18 to 29-year-olds are the ones who are very much open to socialism because it sounds so good. You know, utopia sounds so good. But when you get right down to it, as we all know, it always fails. You can't give everybody a free lunch all the time, expect nothing in return, and have those people thrive. It doesn't work. And we've seen it time and time again in history that it just doesn't work. And so I think we need to, you know, we need to start looking at things again and trying to figure out what we need to do differently. Now, I've written a book. I'll go ahead and plug it really quickly here. It's called Freedom's Fight, A Call to Remember. And it's a book that you can get on Amazon.com. And basically the book is about what's happening right now. I wrote this book last year. It's a political fiction, but it really fits into what's going on right now. And that book, Freedom's Fight, A Call to Remember, is basically a story about a young woman named Bethany who finds herself living on the street away from everyone and everything she's ever known because she doesn't recognize her country anymore and she doesn't fit in. She struggles with the socialism that seems to have taken over, and to keep her sanity, she often finds herself remembering her youth and how things used to be. Then she gets she sets about trying to figure out how to exist in the world that she's no longer a part of by using everything she remembers from her past to try and create a new future. Now, you know, I don't know about you, but sometimes I think today I find myself in very similar situations. And again, when I wrote this book, I really had no idea even a year ago that things would be where they are today. And one of the things that make me see how far, you know, things have progressed and how far we have gone away from where we need to be is when I look at some of these cases on CPS corruption. And, you know, you may be familiar with the Justina Pelletier case that happened in Boston, Massachusetts, in the Boston Children's Hospital. That was a case of a teenager that I think it lasted over 16 months where she came into the hospital and basically was taken away from her parents because of medical abuse issues. And, you know, right now we have another case that's been going on, and that's with Isaiah Ryder. And I don't know how familiar you are with that case, but I want to talk to the attorney on that case, and that is Randy Kretschmar, who represents the mom, Michelle Ryder, in trying to regain custody of Isaiah for mom. And I'm going to have him, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, giving us a background. For those that aren't familiar, I want him to be able to tell us a little bit about a case. About the case. So let's welcome Randy Kretschmar. Randy, are you there?
Yes, Susan, right?
How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. The synopsis, I suppose, for people who are not familiar with the case, Isaiah Ryder was 16 years old. He had a chronic illness. That his mother, as a single mom, had dealt with by herself for 12 years. After a partial amputation of his leg in 2012, they ended up in Chicago to get a stump revision and removal of some tumors, which is all part of his chronic condition. It's called neurofibromatosis. But in the process, I guess he had surgery on the 31st of March, and by the 15th of April, Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago decided that the thing that was wrong with Isaiah more than anything else was his mom, so they took him away from her.
Okay.
That's the nutshell on it. In my opinion, well, I don't know everything about Lurie Children's Hospital's motives, obviously. But it's completely, I mean, their theory of this removal, their theory of taking him away, taking custody, is nonsense. It's pure unadulterated nonsense. Of course, they can probably get away with it. They have gotten away with it for a period of time because they're a big, fancy, wealthy hospital, and she's a single mom. Not even in her own state at the time. But it's a major miscarriage of justice, and we're trying to fix it.
So so a little bit of the background. He this started out about what, age six, when he broke his leg, as I understand, and then started to have multiple surgeries for everything that was going on with him. And then mom was taking him to different hospitals to try to, once he had to have an amputation. Is that correct?
Correct. He had an amputation in 2012.
Okay.
For a number of years, as you say, there were other surgeries trying to fix the leg that had been broken. A lot of hospital admissions, et cetera. Nobody ever accused Michelle Ryder of medical child abuse.
So this medical child abuse, right, when did that start? When did the allegation start, and why do you think that started happening?
Well, it started after the surgery on March 31st at Lurie Children's Hospital. Personally, I think it started happening because somebody was worried that they were going to get sued. A mother of a chronically ill child is understandably anxious, particularly when there's been neurofibromatosis. One is not a curable condition. It's something that has to be dealt with, and it can cause a lot of pain. It causes tumors to grow on the nerve sheathing, as I understand it anyway. So
right.
it's something that has to be coped with for the rest of the person's life. Well, needless to say, there's a lot of stress involved for both the kid and the mother, and Lurie's chose to interpret Michelle Ryder's patience or anger with them when they couldn't handle Isaiah's pain. They didn't know how to handle his pain. Of course, she's going to react to that. They chose to interpret that as something that it wasn't. At best, it was a terrible mistake, and at worst, it was a tactic to protect themselves from perhaps some fear of a malpractice suit.
And didn't they keep her away from him for a number of days where she wasn't even allowed to speak with him? Was that?
Yeah, I think 26 days or something like that.
Okay.
There were all kinds of things in the way this happened in April and May that technically are just illegal. There were a lot of procedural things that were done wrong. After the fact, of course, now we're in a position of trying to get full custody back for Isaiah Ryder to his mother. He's 17 years old already. In less than a year, when he's 18, none of this will count anymore. But it counts for Michelle. She's accused of this, and if she doesn't completely refute these allegations, it stays on her record. It's hard to work as a nurse when you have something like that on your record. But the good thing is Isaiah's at least back in his home state in Kansas City. He's with his grandparents, not very far away from Michelle, but he wants to be home. He wants to be in his own house with his mother.
Right. And I don't want people to misunderstand either and think that, everything's okay, Isaiah's back home, and now we can just move forward. It's just like you said, he's not back with his mother. He's not even allowed, is he allowed to even be with her alone?
Well, he's not. No, he's not. There are all kinds of ridiculous strings. And ironically, the Missouri Child Protective authorities don't seem to really care about this. They seem to think it's kind of wrong. But Illinois still has their strings on Isaiah, still has mom on a leash, and it's oppressive. It's not good for anybody. You know, this is a kid that has a lot of healing to do in a lot of different ways, and it's really hard when there's a government agency that is utterly irrational and machine-like, rolling over your family for no good reason. You know, you're 16, 17 years old. How does that affect you? It doesn't help.
Well, and when he was placed in foster care when he was in Illinois, correct?
Yes.
And tell me a little bit more about what happened there, because it sounded like the circumstances that he was under weren't ideal situations.
No, it wasn't ideal situations. He was I'm liable to get in a lot of trouble for this, but basically, it seemed to me the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services and the subcontractor that they hired were basically trying to turn him into a ghetto kid. I mean, they put him on the south side of Chicago, or near south suburb of Chicago called Dalton, where 99% of high school graduates don't go to college or something like that. You know, within a couple of weeks, Isaiah had a gun stuck in his ribs a couple of times. Everybody he knew was smoking weed or dealing drugs. I wasn't there. Maybe the foster care lady really did her best, and she's basically a nice lady and so on. But it doesn't change the fact that all kinds of bad things happened. He got stuff stolen. You know, it was traumatic. And he was told, this is your only choice. This is your only life now. Get used to it.
Wow. It doesn't seem like the environment that they placed him in was anywhere near the environment that he came from. So that must have been really traumatic.
Yeah, his school system in Kansas City was way better. And his neighborhood, his family, it was a dramatically different world.
And so how is he doing now?
As far as I know, he's doing fine. He's in school. He's wrestling. He's healthy. Doesn't seem like there's any problem for the time being, you know. Mm-hmm. And maybe the Illinois Department of Family Services will say it's because they're paying so much attention to his circumstances. I don't think so, though. You know, I think it's because he's back in his own hometown with his family.
Yeah, I would tend to agree that, you know, kids do well, do a lot better when they're with their family than when they're with strangers in a neighborhood that they've never been in, with circumstances they've never been in. I think being with family is ideal. I think the best situation for kids, of course, is to be back, you know, with their parents. That's the typical, what you see is in their best interest. So tell me what Michelle is going through at this point and what kind of road she's going down now, legal-wise, if you will.
Well, she's fighting these allegations. We're in the second part of the juvenile procedure in Illinois. There's the initial emergency custody or temporary custody proceeding, which was over with before I got involved in the case. And then the second part of it is the adjudicatory proceeding, which simply decides, in this case, by clear and convincing evidence that's required, decides whether or not there was abuse or neglect. If they decide there was abuse or neglect, then the third
part of the procedure is disposition hearing or trial, in which they figure out, you know, what happens to the kid. Well, by the time we get to that in this case, he's going to be almost 18 years old anyway, I think. Anyway, Michelle is bound and determined to defeat this charge that there was abuse or neglect in this case. And I think we will. I think we'll win it.
Because it sounds like a...
We have the top expert, virtually the top expert in the world, on Friday testify in the court, and his name's Mark Feldman. He's a psychiatrist and professor from University of Alabama in Birmingham, and basically he said it's ridiculous to imagine abuse or neglect in this case. He just doesn't see it at all.
It sounds like the only abuse and neglect that they can try to blame on her is being a mom who wanted a second opinion. I mean, that's kind of what I don't know all the facts, but I'm not seeing anything that would suggest that she did something so irregular that a mom, you know, moms wouldn't do. It's like the Pelletier case where they asked for a second opinion and then Justina was taken away. I mean, it sounds very similar in this case. She wanted a second opinion and help for him, and then that was seen as abusive. I mean,
the moment was this. On the 2nd or 3rd of April, I think, after the surgery on the 31st of March, he was having these pain episodes where his leg was shaking and he was in terrible pain. It would come and go, and it actually started during the surgery, oddly enough, when he was under anesthetic. Obviously, Michelle couldn't have caused that. But the pain episodes continued for a couple of days, and you know, they had all been full of hope and enthusiasm that this surgery was going to end that, and it apparently made it worse. And Michelle was becoming discouraged. Isaiah was becoming discouraged. And on the 2nd, I think it was the 2nd of April, the surgeon came to the room, and Michelle complained and said, "Geez, you know, seems like this hasn't worked. No, they're not doing anything to control his pain." And the surgeon kind of threw up his hands and said, "We've had everybody here, more people come in on this case and you know, than anybody else in the hospital. We don't know what else to do." He threw his hands up. And at that moment, Michelle thought, you know what, that's not good enough. I want to transfer to another hospital. And as she started saying she wanted a transfer, that's when people started saying, you know what, maybe the problem is her. They didn't want to transfer him. They very early got together, the clinicians, a particular psychiatrist by the name of Stacy Greeter and other clinicians got together and said, you know what, we have to present the United Front. There's not going to be any transfer. And they started that almost immediately. The problem was not anything that mom did other than say, "I want to take him out of this hospital."
That's just amazing. I saw a video. I don't know if it was posted on YouTube or where exactly that I saw it. I don't recall. But I remember seeing a video that someone had taken of Isaiah's like legs that was spasming. His leg was just moving uncontrollably. You know, and that to me, when I looked at that, there's no way that you can fake that. I mean, that was just incredible to see that somebody's leg was so out of control and moving. And, you know, I didn't see anything where, you know, Michelle was causing that. You know, there's no way that she could have caused that. And there's no way that anybody, any human, could have caused that type of spasming in his leg.
Exactly. It's not subtle. It wasn't subtle. His pain wasn't subtle. His underlying physiological condition of neurofibromatosis. One is not subtle. It's not like Michelle could have caused any of this. The only thing that Michelle caused was some kind of fear or nervousness in people at Lurie's Children's Hospital when she started saying, I want to transfer, I want to take him somewhere else.
Right. Now, has she been able, I know she goes back and forth between Missouri and Illinois, what, about a 500-mile trip to go to court? I mean, is she able to work? What, you know, financially, is she able to afford all of this? I mean, what has that done to her life?
It's turned her life upside down. It's immobilized everybody in the family. Michelle's parents are going through an awful lot of difficulty as well. The state can generally outlast any individual, unfortunately.
Yep.
It takes an extraordinary individual to stand up to the organized oppression from a state agency. So far Michelle's absolutely uncowed on this.
For other parents that might be going through something similar, any advice or suggestions, I should say, to them and what they can do if confronted with something like this?
Obviously, you know, it makes sense to try and collaborate with people, even if you think they're wrong. When you know, if you should know that they have this power, that they can do this. So it makes sense not to unnecessarily antagonize people, not to unnecessarily appear to be some sort of refusenik or some sort of outlying fanatic or anything like that when it comes to medical decisions, medical procedures. When doctors say, here's what we should be doing, well, be respectful. If you disagree, pay close attention to how they're taking your disagreement, because if they take it wrong, you know what, they can come after you with state power. So remember that to begin with. The second piece of advice is you have to know that you have to know that you can win. You have to know that ultimately it's your responsibility and it's your right to raise your own children and take care of your own children. And when the state tries to deny that, you have to fight them. Ultimately, you have to. We all have to.
Right. It almost sounds like, and this is preposterous, that anybody who's has a child in the hospital and they want a second opinion, they should call an attorney first before they even mention it to the hospital.
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, if you call the attorney first and the hospital knows you've got an attorney there, you know what? Here's what you do. You act like you're doing everything they want you to do, and you're the perfect patient, you're the perfect parent, you're doing exactly what the doctors want, you agree 100% until the last possible moment when you have to tell them to go scratch, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You save it. But I'll tell you, when you do tell them, I'm sorry, I'm out of here, then you better have your attorney. But maybe you don't show that up front, because all it does is put them on guard. It just makes them worry, and you don't want them to worry.
Right. It doesn't sound like there's a real win-win situation that anybody, you know, what you can really do is it's foolproof. It's kind of sort of feeling your way around it, and I think you're right. You know, you just seem as though you're agreeing with the hospital and everything's fine and questioning more than you are saying what you're going to do, and I think that's where some parents have gotten in trouble when they say, okay, we're out of here, and And by that time, they're very frustrated and they just want out in the hospital. All they want to do is keep him in at that point because they're afraid of what's going to happen and the publicity that's going to come from that.
Yeah, you have to be ahead of them. You have to pay attention. You have to know what they're thinking, and you have to control yourself. They've got a lot of power, and many families, many parents, even adult patients don't realize how much power they have. Don't realize that they can call the state. I mean, look at somebody who maybe comes out of surgery and they're very depressed. Well, you know what? Somebody sees them as being depressed. Perhaps they can commit them to the psych ward if they say the wrong thing at the wrong time. You don't want to be committed. You don't want to be told that you have to take psychotropic medication, perhaps. Well, you know what? You better not sound too depressed. You have to know what the doctors are thinking, what they can do, and you have to keep your options open.
It sounds like there's a fine line and there's a balance here, you know, and that's kind of what I hear you saying. And so, I think, of course, there is.
And by the way, I hasten to add, most doctors and most medical people are extremely well-intended, and many of them are outrageously skilled and knowledgeable and do nothing but help their patients. But it sometimes can turn out much different than that. Sometimes these people become cogs in a machine, which is finely tuned to take away your autonomy and to take away your control over your own life. And once that machine gets turned on and once it's aimed at you, you're in a lot of trouble and you've got a big, long fight on your hands.
That could take possibly years, you know, for some people, depending upon the issue. And like you said earlier, we were talking about, you know, financially, this is a tremendous drain on anyone who goes up against the big government machine. And I know, I want to tell people where they can donate if they want to, and they can donate for Isaiah and to help in the funding of all this. And that's bringisaiahhome.org. Again, bringisaiahhome.org. And Isaiah is ISAIAH. And there's also a group that's on Facebook called Team Isaiah. And you can go there and learn a lot of information. And on my website at SusanKnowles.com, I have a lot of stories that I did, articles that I did in regards to Isaiah. You can check them out there and learn more about this, because I think a lot of times we always feel it's never going to happen to us. And then, you know, when it does happen, you know, it's too late then, and you're really in the muck and mire, as they say, at that point. And it's better to know about these things, be prepared about them, you know, help out if you can financially to support, the fees and everything that's going into what Michelle has to do in trying to clear her name and regain custody of her son. So I hope that everyone will go there. And I know on the announcement of this show, I've put that on there in case you forget the names. You'll find that information on the announcement of this show of where you can go and donate, and the Facebook page as well. So, Randy, before I let you go, anything else that wasn't said that you would like to say?
Well, I can't think of anything. I mean, you,
okay.
I could wax dramatic on some of these points, but I'll just stay. I'll just stay the lawyer for the moment.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your coming and being on my first show, and I know that Michelle and Isaiah really appreciate all that you're doing and getting the word out about what's going on with Isaiah. And you know, you're welcome to come back anytime for anything that comes up, any case that you want to talk about that you want to get out there in the public. You know, please don't hesitate to come back.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, and you take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. So there you have it. You've heard from the attorney, and you kind of know a little bit about what's going on. And again, if you're not familiar with this case, you know, go to Team Isaiah on Facebook, and there's a lot of information there, and they can put you in touch with other places that you need to go and things that you can read. But like I said, you know, to donate, it's bringisaiahhome.org. It's very important. You know, we kind of seem to want to, again, we've got so much that we're doing, we sort of put these things off and say, well, you know, I'm sure everything's fine. You know, he's back home now. And that's just not the case. No, this goes on and on. Michelle Ryder would be the one that, you know, have to tell you what it's like for her to go back and forth 500 miles every time that she has to go to court. Probably, I think, maybe once every 2 weeks is when she's going, maybe even more than that. And you can't work. You know, it's hard to work. It's hard to be a nurse, I would imagine, just like Randy said, and try to have a job when you're being accused of medical abuse. I mean, that's, you're a nurse, for God's sake. You know, very difficult. So life is not back to normal for these people, and we can't assume that it is. So please go there and check all of that out. And I really appreciate, you know, Randy being on and taking time out to, you know, talk to us about these things. You know, I do hope that we can continue to have more of these subjects that come up. This is happening more and more to people all the time, and we just don't hear about it in the news because, frankly, they don't want us to hear about it because, you know, if you really knew the facts, the inside and out of these cases, you would be just up in arms about it. And I worked with CPS myself, and I've had where I have seen their clients or the kids that they have taken and removed from the families, and I would have to say that the cases I've been involved with, you know, they've been very, very good cases, but I'll have to tell you, I've seen a couple where sitting there, you know, the parents go through and they do everything that they're supposed to do. They think they're in reunification, and it comes down to it at the very end, and they take the kids away. So don't think that just because you're doing everything that CPS tells you to do, that everything's going to be all right, because that just is not the case. And, you know, I don't practice law anymore, but, you know, for people who are out there in this situation, talk to your attorney, find out what he or she thinks about taking this public, you know, and I would go to anybody and everybody. I would try Dr. Phil, you know, Huckabee, you know, anybody who would listen to me on TV, radio, or anywhere else, because the more that you stay quiet, the more they have an opportunity to do what they do under the cover of darkness. With the Pelletier case, I'm convinced if Lou Pelletier had stayed quiet as he was supposed to with a gag order, I believe that Justina would still be at Boston Children's Hospital. Because up until that point, it was a losing situation for the Pelletier family. And once that hit, you know, the blaze and got on to Huckabee Show, and Reverend Mahoney came out and also helped with the family, and Liberty Council, they had everybody on their side, and that started to make a difference. And I really feel that in any case like this, you're going to have the exposure. So, again, thank you, Randy. And I kind of want to move on to another subject. You know, as I said, I want to be able to talk to you about items in the news that are important. And I want you to be able to call in and talk as well and ask questions or say what you want to say on a different subject. I'm calling you, you know, from California and on the radio with you in California, and I know a lot of things are happening here in terms of the Second Amendment, and I don't know how many people are aware of it, but we've recently had our governor sign into law something that I feel really takes the gun rights away from the people in California, and I don't think too many Californians right now are aware of it. I wrote an article that's posted on my website, fight and also for Joe for America. And it's called From My Cold Dead Hand Has Been Accomplished by California. And basically, if you remember, Charlton Heston is the one that said, you know, you take this gun from my cold, dead hands. And, you know, California did just that when Governor Brown signed AB 1014. And that that bill, when he signed it into law, was based upon, I don't know if you remember back in May 2014, when Elliot Rodger went on a rampage at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He had basically, according to all reports, had killed, I believe it was his roommates, with a knife, and then went out, you know, started shooting people and everything else. So there were knives and guns involved in his, you know, his rampage. And what happened was the police were called and sent to his home to talk to him, and they did go out and talk to him. I think his parents, Roger's parents, had called him to his home. They did talk to Elliot Rodger's parents, but they didn't find anything wrong. I think the parents had said, you know, he's got a weird video that's posted on YouTube, and we're not sure. We think there's something, maybe he's suicidal. We don't know. We want you to talk to him. So they talked to him, found out in their own minds everything was fine. They didn't go in the house, as far as I remember. And then he went on this rampage. So people, you know, led by the Democrats, of course, felt that there needed to be a new law. And basically what this law does is it allows a law enforcement officer or family member to ask a court for a restraining order against any person that they believe is a threat to themselves or others. And if this restraining order is granted, the person will be barred from possessing a firearm for at least 21 days. So essentially, you know, the burden is then on the person who has the restraining order against them to prove that they're not a threat to themselves or others. And, you know, it's very difficult to prove something that isn't. So we've automatically made it very difficult. And these restraining orders can be extended for any amount of time past that 21 days. So they're not in the clear after that. And the person who... the family member, you know, if they call and they ask for this restraining order and they lie, they're looking at facing misdemeanor charges. But, you know, it, again, a judge has to prove that they lied. How difficult is that going to be for a court to say, oh, well, they lied and they really weren't a threat to themselves or others? Because at the time, maybe they were, and later they're not. You know, who knows? But it's... again, it's set up for the gun owner to have all the responsibility of proving things so that he or she can get their guns back. And another thing that really bothers me about this, two things actually. One is, what are we calling a family member? You know, in our society today, a family member can be a lot of people. You know, does that mean it has to be a spouse? Does it mean somebody that you just live with, who, you know, your girlfriend, your boyfriend? Is it somebody who happens to be living in the house but isn't really a blood relative to you? You know, it could be a number of people, and the law really doesn't specify exactly who a family member is. It's very broad. Another thing is that California currently has a law. It's California Welfare and Institutions Code, Section 5150, and it provides for any law enforcement officer to take a person into custody that they believe is a danger to themselves or others. And then what they immediately have to do is to take that person to a mental health provider and get them assessed. So you're talking about having a professional then who is going to make that determination. Should we continue to hold this person? Should we let them go? Did the police officers made a mistake? Or should we keep them because they really are a threat to themselves or others? And then this new law signed by Governor Jerry Brown, AB 1014, there's no requirement here of a mental health professional at all. So, you know, anybody who maybe is a little bit ticked off at you, who lives in your house, who may or may not be blood relative to you, can call up and say, you know what, I think so-and-so here, he's been acting a little funny lately. He's arguing a lot with me, and I think he may be a threat to me because I think I heard him say, you know, if you don't cut that out, I'm just going to, you know, scream or do something. So, again, you know, how far, I know it sounds ridiculous, but how far do we stretch this law to kind of get what we want? You know, when I was practicing law, I was a family law attorney. I saw people all of the time come in and ask for a temporary restraining order against their spouse or boyfriend, girlfriend. And they alleged all kinds of things that were in, you know, they put into the restraining order, things that were embarrassing to read at times. And you know what? They didn't have to prove it. Typically, the judge would err on the side of, hey, you know what? I don't want to get involved in a lawsuit. If something does happen and they kill this person, I certainly don't want my name out there in the public. So I'm going to go ahead and grant this temporary restraining order. So, you know, it can be done very easily. And again, it's very hard to prove that at the time that somebody didn't think that the person was actually making a threat. It's going to be impossible to prove that. And so I don't know what, if anything, the gun owner will have in retribution. I don't know if they can go after, you know, for some type of civil lawsuit of false allegations, you know, defamation, or if they're protected, if the person who's alleging that they made a threat, if that person is protected under this law such that, you know, a lawsuit can't be brought against them for making false claims. So it'll be interesting to see. It's always something that California seems to be doing, you know, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little at a time to take our guns away from us. And unfortunately, because California is such a blue state, people don't realize what's coming. They sort of make light of it and laugh. I've actually been at you know, cafeterias and sitting there, and I hear them talking about, oh, those people, they always think they're, you know, we're going to have our guns taken away. They're not taking our guns away, you know. And yes, they are. They're taking our guns away. But nobody wants to look at it that way. And the state, and you know, it's not just California. It's moving across the nation that there are going to be people who say, we're slowly taking your guns away. Nobody really notices that they're doing it. It's all for the kids. And don't worry, we'll never take your guns away. And what they don't realize, and I know, again, this sounds so ridiculous to say, criminals don't follow the laws. They just don't. And so you can take guns away from anybody you want to, and somebody who was, you know, who wants to, like what they did in Canada, can go out and kill someone, you know. And again, here's Canada with the strictest gun laws that they have. You can't even take a gun, even when you have a license, you can't take a gun outside of your house. Even a concealed, you can't carry a concealed weapon. You can't take it outside of your house. How you're supposed to practice and get better, you know, I don't know. But the gentleman, the Corporal Nathan Cirillo, who was standing guard in Canada, he had no bullets in his gun. He had no chance. You know, how many sentries do you know stand guard with no bullets in their gun? As a matter of fact, the guy who ended up, you know, killing the man who shot Nathan Cirillo, he had to run and find a gun and then load it and then come back and kill him. I mean, some people's lives, you know, could have been spared. Nathan Cirillo's life could have been spared. The other person who was shot, you know, that could have been prevented. For the mere fact, there were no bullets in anybody's gun. So I don't understand how people can just assume, you know, that the government's going to be there to protect us. You know, again, in Canada at least, most of their people aren't even armed. You know, they have no bullets. So how are they going to protect you? And here, our Second Amendment protects us from the government coming in and taking over. That's why we need, under the Second Amendment, which is our constitutional right, to keep and bear arms. So, you know, keep looking for things to happen, because once it starts in California, kind of goes across the United States. So if we have a gun law here like that, I've written articles about it, I warned people about it before this law was ever signed. It's going to roll across, people. And you have to be aware that it's coming, and you have to stand up and stop people from doing this in your state. Speak out about it. Get people together. I don't know, you know, if you're a member of the Tea Party or whomever. Get a group of your own people together. Get out there and talk to people. Tell them, you know, why this is so ridiculous and what this could mean to their rights. And be armed. Be ready to tell them how the government in the past has taken away rights because the people thought nothing was ever going to happen and that everything was going to be okay. I want to talk to you next week about different things that we can do. Again, I want to be a show that talks solutions. I want you to be able to call in. I want you to help with these solutions, because you are just like me. We're out there together. We need to work together. We need to stand together. We need to stand for truth and get things done, so that we won't be the people who sit there and say, how in the world did that happen? I didn't see that coming. We see it coming. We know it's coming. We need to do something about it. We need to stay vigilant, and we need to share the word and get people involved. So do your homework. Get your facts together. We'll talk about more facts here. Again, it's very important to do that. And in the coming weeks, you know, I want to hear from you. I really do. On Twitter, I'm at Susan Knowles. Again, it's SusanKnowles. And you'll find my articles, SusanKnowles.com, JoeForAmerica.com, and other places. So I really want you to be here. I want you to be involved. We can't any longer just sit back and wait for somebody else to do it. Guess what? We're the somebody else's. We're the ones, we're called to do it. Nobody is going to do it for us. And I know people are working hard. They have a lot to do. They have a lot on their plate. But we have to be the ones that stand up. We've got to find the energy somewhere. Together, we can do this. Together, we can make a difference. Together, we can change America into what it should have been changed into, which was a better America, not something that Obama wanted to change it into, but what we all know that it's here for. You know, we're here for God, family, and country, and we need to start showing everybody that that's why we're here. So thank you again, you know, for being here on the first show with me. It's been great. I hope that you will go to bringisaiahhome.org and help fund Michelle and her fight to get custody of Isaiah Ryder. It's very important. And again, it can happen to anyone who has children at the blink of an eye. And if you think that it can't, then it's going to be too late when it does happen. I think Randy gave us a lot of good things to think about and how to approach something like this. If it happens to you, God forbid that it would ever happen to you. So the upcoming week, you know, take care. And we will talk about, again, a lot of different subjects. I want you to be ready. And you can just tweet to me on Twitter and let me know of any subjects that you want to hear about. I'd be more than happy to talk to you about them and bring them on the radio show. Hopefully next week you will be tuning in, calling in, and until then, stand for truth. It's very important. Good night.